The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got some nice questions lined up for you, I'm assured, by Jim, the controller of said questions. I believe we've also got a public service announcement or two, which is a new feature, I guess, on the Retirement and IRA Show, where listeners that have gleaned some nugget of information that would be helpful to other retirees, sharing it with us, and we make that a public service announcement. We're also going to do, I'm assuming, the hot new question of the week. We got all kinds of features now on the new 2022 version of the Retirement and IRA Show is getting pretty darn exciting. So I'll bring Jim in here since he's the master of all questions and see what he's got for us first.
Good morning, Chris. Actually, afternoon now. Yeah, good afternoon.
We can pretend it's morning. That's, you know, usually releases in the morning, so there's a lot of people who listen in the morning. So good morning, everyone.
Good morning. It is actually afternoon as we record this. It is Saturday, today is Friday. I'm all over the place. I don't know what the hell I'm doing. It is Friday, early afternoon. Mm-hmm. If it was late afternoon, I have an excuse. It's only early afternoon. You know why my head is fried, folks? I just attended 6 hours of training on the new 275-page proposed IRS regulations on required minimum distributions. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, folks, if the proposed regulations become law, and we won't know until summer. That's one reason Chris and I have not really been talking about it. We got burned on BBBA. We went deep into it, and then the damn thing never passed. I know a lot of what's in the 275 pages will pass, and I know a lot won't. But if it all did, Chris, they succeeded in taking something that was marginally confusing and turned it into something that is just so unbelievably confusing, my head is spinning. I don't know what they're smoking. They must be coming to Colorado and vacationing because of all the dope here, and then writing the laws, because it's just crazy.
What do you mean by all the dope here?
There's the state has a ton of dope here.
There's no more dope here than there ever was.
There is. It's everywhere. They changed a restaurant down the road from my house into a dope place. It's just nuts. But anyway,
it's called a commercial enterprise that is now legal.
That's the ex-cop in me there. But anyways, so we will be doing shows on this. We've received two emails so far asking when are we going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And we haven't yet because I don't know what's going to see the light of day. There's a couple of provisions that are really good. They did simplify. I told you earlier today when I was taking a break from my 6 hours, one of the provisions, and we don't have to get into it, but you thought, oh, wow, that's going to make things easier. Mm-hmm. But the provisions with trusts, oh, my God, just have made it incredibly confusing. And if you didn't think trust. I hated trust as beneficiaries of IRAs before.
Maybe they're trying to send a signal. Don't do it.
Maybe I should mail them, you know, because we have till the 15th of May to reply. Maybe I should mail them some Colorado dope and say, here, smoke this and go back and rewrite it.
Well, because they just didn't get it right. Still illegal.
I thought this was so pure and innocent. Now all of a sudden you can't mail it?
You're just saying there's a lot more of it. It's the same. It's just being sold in a different way.
Whatever. All right. Anyways, folks, it's going to be interesting seeing how much of this passes. It will make trusts far, far more complex. It's not going to improve the trust tax rates, unfortunately. But I think a lot of people are going to start chomping on this post-death planning, which really isn't complete post-death planning, but they have given trusts more flexibility post-death to do a little bit of planning that they couldn't do prior to these proposed rules. So I'm curious to see how much of that will pass. And I think competent estate planning attorneys might be able to use this to people's advantage. But of course, Chris, it does not remove the horrendous tax rates on IRA proceeds being paid to a trust. So the cynic in me says they're trying to appeal to more people creating trusts so they can get even more taxes than they could with the ability to do post-death planning with trusts. So anyways, we'll see. I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. But that explains why my head was a little bit fried. Apologize for that, folks. We're going to jump into Social Security questions. I got two. Because, you know, we're answering questions from November. We ran out of Social Security questions from November. Mm-hmm. So I entered December for Social Security questions.
Yeah.
And there were two that just happened to come in on December 7th. You're going to nail one? I don't know if the second one might stump you. So
we'll see.
Don't go too deep into the first one so you can flood like a fish out of water on the second one.
Okay.
All right, it begins. Hello, Jim and Chris. I'm a new listener to your podcast and have been very impressed with Jim. He's amazing. And with the in-depth content you provide. So clearly the man's a genius, like last week's genius.
He's just buttering you up to get on the podcast sooner than later. It didn't work. It's still from December.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe I ad-libbed a little bit there. Who knows?
Okay.
I have a question. My mother is 85. She retired 25 years ago from a Massachusetts high school after many years of teaching in public schools. Massachusetts is one of a handful of states where teachers have a state pension but do not contribute to Social Security, so they get no Social Security. Mm-hmm. Prior to teaching, though, my mother had a non-government job where she did pay in a Social Security. She does not have enough credits or working quote-unquote quarters to qualify based on her time alone. She said she is close, but she didn't quite make it. I don't know the exact number of quarters she earned or how many more she needs. Using some online calculators that calculate Social Security after the windfall elimination provision, it doesn't appear she would even receive any Social Security. So despite all this, is there a way she could then just get back what she paid in? Is she entitled to a refund or at least get some of the money back? It doesn't seem fair to her that she paid in and contributed to the system and won't get any money out. I realize you may not have all the facts you need to answer this question. My mother accepted a long time ago that Social Security is not going to be hers, so she has not actively pursued this issue. But it bothers me, and that's why I'm contacting you. Gives his name. He's from Connecticut. Mom's from Massachusetts. We'll call him George. I don't think you have good news for George.
No, and I think George is making a common mistake is envisioning Social Security as an account that you're paying into and building up. So it's sitting there and it's yours. That's not how Social Security works. There's no refunds. If you pass away before collecting, you don't get anything. Your heirs don't get anything. It's a direct transfer from current workers to current retirees. That's how the system works, other than the surplus that's been accumulated in anticipation of the baby boomers. That's going to come out of that trust account to supplement what's being paid in by current workers, because current workers aren't paying in enough to pay out to all the baby boomers who are retiring now. So the trust fund is making up the difference for now. That's the thing that's threatened to, quote, run out possibly in the, well, likely in the early 2030s. But it's not an account attached to your name. You're creating credits in the system. And under the rules, you have to amass at least 40 credits or quarters. And if you don't get that, you get nothing as far as a retirement benefit. There's other benefits that are possible that are kind of secondary, disability benefits, those sorts of things. That's not going to apply in this particular case, where you don't have to have a full 40 credits or quarters. But there's a lot of people who come here and work for a while, maybe work for 5 years in this country and then go back to their home country or something. They've paid into the system, leave it all behind. That happens. So there's lots of times when people pay in and don't get anything or don't get as much as they paid in. If you pass away real early, you claim and you earned a benefit, but you only live for a few years, that's it. You don't get anything. That's the way it works. That's how the system affords to pay people who live excessively long. It's a shared pooled system, essentially, that's designed to do something, but it is not designed to amass an account that you would receive. Now, if she doesn't have all the credits, it's likely, and especially if it was early in her life, prior to this teaching career, the benefit she could have gotten if she worked a little bit longer, maybe to, let's assume she's close to the 40 credits and could get there with a little bit extra work, it's not going to unlock much of a benefit. So if it's any consolation, I don't think she's leaving much behind. You could look in her Social Security account and see how much was put in there, because on your Social Security benefit estimate statement, it's going to show how much was put in by you and how much was put in by your employer over your working life. And it's not going to be a very large amount, likely, is my guess, given the facts. I don't have all the details, but the simple answer to his question is no, she's not entitled to anything if she hasn't gotten the requisite number of credits.
Perfect. That's what I thought you were going to say. This next one is a fairly straightforward question.
Thought you said it was tricky.
Well, it's straightforward. I don't know if you're not going to know the answer. It's not tricky. I just don't know if you know the answer. I will be impressed if you know the answer.
You've got me nervous now. But if I don't know, I don't know. I promise everyone something, though. I will look it up, and I will answer it next week.
Yeah. So. Because I wasn't sure. Okay. Anyways. Dear Jim, Chris, and Bob, nice little shout out to Bob there. She is from New York. We are going to call her George, as always. Or Georgette, seeing it's a female. She did give her real name. I have been a longtime listener from New York and enjoy every minute of your show, especially listen to Jim.
No.
He
stop.
Is amazing. I'm just ad-libbing a little.
Clearly.
Not only are your podcasts full of valuable information, the subtle humor and interaction between Chris and Jim often bring a big smile to my face. It is such a wonderful learning experience with so much fun. Oh, good. I'm glad she likes our subtle approach. I have a question about the timing of receiving Social Security benefits and the timing of Medicare premiums for my husband. Below is some information. He will turn 70 May 29th of 2022. Now, remember, she sent this to us last December. Mm-hmm. So he's going to turn 70, Chris, in a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And will be claiming his full, as she put it, fully delayed Social Security age 70 benefits. Mm-hmm. Since his birthday is on the 29th and Social Security benefits are paid 1 month behind, this means he will not receive his first check until the fourth Wednesday of June,
correct,
2022. Mm-hmm. He is subject to IRMA, and currently the Medicare premium of $545.90 is deducted automatically on the 20th of every month from his checking account. Do you want me to pause there to explain to people that if you're not claiming Social Security, they're still going to bill you for Medicare?
You just said it.
Okay.
That's true. You're going to pay on your own for it because they, once you sign up for and claim your Social Security benefit, you can't continue to do it that way. It's required that it be subtracted from your Social Security. And if for some reason your Social Security isn't big enough, they're going to wipe it out and bill you for the rest.
Exactly. And IRMA, for folks who don't understand that, income-related monthly adjusted amount, IRMAA, we just call it by the acronym IRMA. They're earning, quote-unquote, too much money in the eyes of the government and therefore can, quote-unquote, afford to pay more in Medicare premiums. So they're hitting these IRMA limits. If you're a new listener and don't understand IRMA, just Google it. And you will see more than you ever wanted on IRMA and how it works. Okay, she continues. The most recent Medicare premium bill received is now $615, which is due on December 25th for next year's coverage beginning January 1st of 2022. So remember, she sent this to us last year, and it's reflecting the increase in Medicare premiums. Mm-hmm. So she's just setting the stage, Chris. Here's her question. I understand that when he begins Social Security, Medicare premiums will be automatically deducted from his very first Social Security benefit check, which, as I said, he will receive on the fourth Wednesday of June. What does that deducted Medicare premium cover? Is that for the Medicare coverage period of May 2022, June 2022, or July of 2022? I just want to confirm when Medicare is going to stop debiting from our checking account the $615.60. I thought that was a good question because I don't know.
That's an excellent question, and we haven't covered that on the show before. And I am not confident enough in my answer to say it. So you're right. I'm going to have to verify that for sure. Someone out there probably knows, and they're probably going to email me. But I think I know. But I'm not even going to hazard, you know, it's not really an educated guess. I've seen this before, but it's been a long time since I've looked at it, and I'm, you know, it's late in the afternoon now on a Friday.
No, it's not, folks. It's 1:30. And you are not attending a 6-hour class on the new.
What do you think I've been doing all day? I've been working.
I thought you were out in the cabana in the backyard of the office.
I wish.
Relaxing.
I wish. But yeah, oh, that's an excellent question because, I believe it's not going to be for May. I believe it's going to be for June or July. For the husband, the Social Security benefit for May is payable in June. They will withhold it from that payment. And I suspect that it's for July, since they make you pay it ahead of time. As she mentioned, the December 25th, it was due for January. But I'm going to verify that, make sure. That's a great question because it's something we have not talked about on here before.
I think it's looking forward, like you said. So it's definitely not going to be May's. My gut tells me it's going to be June's, but that's my thought. Okay.
Yep. So we'll circle back to this one. Make sure you leave that one set aside so we don't forget to touch on that. And I'll make a note right now to verify that for sure.
I'm going to forward it to you right now.
Okay.
And
perfect.
Then you can always remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Now we have question of the week.
Nice.
And I'm torn because we have two
good ones.
One from a real fighter pilot. And you know how I want to kind of reference things recent? So This has from our show last week or a couple weeks ago when I said my fighter pilot name would be Bryce Stetson or Stetson. Mm-hmm. And he just went into how fighter pilots actually get their nicknames. I found it fascinating. But he's a real fighter pilot, yes, listening to us. Mm-hmm. And then he had some good questions on life insurance. And then we got a good question on our minimum dignity floor from last week. Mm-hmm. So maybe we will end up doing both. How's that?
Sure. I'm game.
Okay. So, folks, if you ever wondered how fighter pilots get their call sign, here's an email from a real fighter pilot. Dear Jim and Chris, thank you for my favorite podcasts. I always find them informative and fun to listen to, especially when I'm flying dangerous missions. I threw that part in.
Stop. You're really ad-libbing today for some reason.
I listen to them on long commutes and look forward to the drive when I download a new episode. Well done. Uh-huh. I do have a question, but before, let me begin with a commentary. As an Air Force fighter pilot, I intend this to be humorous, but with the utmost respect. I listened with interest on your discussion of the fighter pilot name or the call sign as it is known. Jim, your call sign suggestion of calling yourself Stetson is a worthy one, but you need to know that in all but very rare circumstances, in most fighter pilot communities, you do not get to choose your own call
name.
Sign.
Right, yeah.
You knew that, really?
I knew that, but...
Okay.
I was humoring you in...
Well, I didn't know that, folks, and I'm sure many of our listeners did.
You get anointed. Yeah, go ahead.
I'll continue. Yeah. Your call sign is generally nominated by and voted on by your fellow squadron fighter pilots in a forum that can take various forms based on squadron traditions. Ooh. Individuals will nominate a call sign and tell the story to justify why that call sign would fit you. If you have a previous call sign that you want to keep, I guess maybe from another squadron, I don't know. If you have a previous call sign that you want to keep, you may be given an opportunity to defend your existing call sign. All nominations will be listed, then usually after several cycles of voting, to determine your new call sign. I mean, they take this seriously.
Yeah, I didn't know all those details. That's cool.
Yeah, well, neither did I. The things you learn on the Retirement and IRA Show, folks.
Yeah, we haven't talked about this one at all, for sure.
He continues. The reasons for specific suggestions can come from a variety of sources. First, something done extremely well. So here he's going to get into giving you and I call signs.
Ooh.
First, something done extremely well, such as Chris keeping Jim on task during the show. I could nominate a call sign for him of Ringmaster.
Or Cat Herder.
No, Cat Herder. He didn't put that in there, but Ringmaster. Yeah. Rolex. Mm. Not Rolo. That would be for a whole other reason to call you Rolo. Mm-hmm. But Rolex or Cowboy. For reining someone in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice.
So which calls, because we should go by our call sign names now. So what do you want to be? Rolo? That's my recommendation. Ringmaster, Rolex, or Cowboy?
I think
What was the one you said? You
I
like
said
Cowboy?
Cat Herder, but I think of those three, I would probably pick Cowboy because it also ties in to me being born in Wyoming.
True.
And also have an undergraduate degree from the University of Wyoming, who are the Cowboys. So that would probably be the most applicable.
Perfect. Listeners, Chris will now go by the call sign Cowboy.
Cowboy. Okay.
Cowboy. All right. Now for yours truly. Macho. No. For Jim, his ability to dive deep in answering questions, nominations could be Scuba. Or alternatively, going down rabbit holes, we could call him Bugs. I like that one, Bugs. Note that just those quick suggestions can quickly escalate and riff in a completely different direction. A second for Jim might be for specific...
You could be specific, you could be Elmer or Fudd.
Well...
with the rabbit holes.
Our fighter pilot is quickly going into a black hole here with what he wrote next. Uh-oh. A second for Jim might be for specific acts of buffoonery. Humorous takes on tactical mistakes or quirks, like his gymisms, as a known predilection for mixing metaphors. We could call him Malifor.
Nice. You don't like that one?
Malifor?
No.
Isn't that when you muff up or mix kinda, two metaphors together? Yeah, that would be me, Malifor. I kind of like Bugs. Cowboy and Bugs.
I kind of like
Bugs
Fudd.
Bunny. Fudd. Elmer Fudd. Well, I do hunt.
And you chase rabbits down rabbit holes.
I do chase rabbits down rabbit holes. I could be Elmer. Mm-hmm. That's true. We have to let our listeners vote if it should be Bugs or Elmer. Third, at least he put a lot more forethought into me.
Yeah, for sure.
Third, it could be something about a person's appearance or given name that just fits. I won't attempt any physical comparisons for you, Jim, but Chris Kringlestein or Jim Call Saul would be examples of this genre. Call Saul? Call Saul? Mm-hmm. I don't get that one, do you? Jim Call Saul?
Yeah, you know, gotta call Saul.
I have no idea what he's talking about.
Oh. Just look it up. It's a TV show.
From Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
That's what I'm assuming he's talking
Bugs.
About.
I'll stick with Bugs. Okay. And you can be Cowboy.
Okay. I'm glad got that all cleared up.
And then you are also allowed a just because catchphrase. So for Jim, this may result in riffs about or from something as simple as, well, Jim wants to be called Stetson. So I nominate Beanie. I don't like that. I don't like Beanie. Beanie ain't going to cut it. So I think Bugs and Cowboy. All right. Okay. Ready, Cowboy? Here's his question.
Okay.
All righty. My question revolves around how to think about life insurance in retirement. I think this could actually be an EDU show. It probably could, listener, but you made it to question of the week. You have mentioned permanent insurance as a guaranteed inheritance plan, but as I'm focused more on the one in my 210 tax number. So what he's saying there, folks, is remember, when you're doing tax planning or retirement planning, it's kind of how he's looking at it, as you'll see with his question, folks. Are we planning for two of you, one of you, or none of you? 210. Very important concept when it comes to the tax planning. But also with retirement planning, he's worried, Chris, if he predeceases his wife. And this is what he shares with us. Excuse me. My wife and I are not overly concerned about the zero in 210. He goes on to describe that his wife has a life insurance policy. My wife's policy has a face value of $322,000 and a cash value of $50,000. I could convert it today to a fully paid-up policy of $184,000. So instead of being $322,000, there's enough in that policy to keep it, quote-unquote, alive, Chris, for a fully paid-up $184,000. And I guess at that point, no more premiums are due. Okay, her current premiums on the policy are $283 a month. Her only known relative, her birth mother, is still alive. So I expect my wife will have average to above average longevity. Do you think I should just leave it? That type of death benefit would buy me a very nice boat. And then he put, my wife would laugh if she heard that. I hope so, because if she's listening that her death is a new boat for you, she may not like it.
You've seen that boat sales place on the highway.
Yes, right? Your wife called and said it's okay.
Yeah, your wife called and said it's okay to buy a boat.
Yeah.
That's their advertisement on the side.
I did see that off the highway. Okay, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Okay. Or do you think I should convert it to pay up? Or do you think I should cash it out and invest that cash value? If I could earn a 6% return, the near $200,000 would break even in 15 years. Which would be age 71 for my spouse, and I do think she would still be alive. Okay, let me just pause there because this is the least of his worry, and he kind of acknowledges that. Mm-hmm. It's so hard for me to ever say to someone what to do with a policy that you've paid into it all these years, because you effectively have been paying whole life or permanent life premiums to a policy you're going to treat as a term policy. So you've been paying very high premiums. Your cash value that you're going to get back, listener, is really just a reflection of excess premiums that you've been paying into the policy to help support it later. Now, depending on if those premiums actually were growing, if this is a VUL, a variable universal life, maybe they've been growing, or an index universal life, maybe they've been earning some interest, or a whole life, maybe they've been earning some dividends. But you still paid significantly more in premiums than you would have if your wife would have just bought a term policy. The other issue, you cancel it on Monday, your wife dies on Tuesday. So you always carry that risk. So I would encourage you to look at what life insurance is designed for. It's designed to make someone economically whole at the passing of someone. Would you suffer an economic hardship at your wife's passing? My answer to that is no, based on what you write in your next question and based on how you joked the death benefit would buy you a really nice boat. So you're not going to suffer an economic hardship if she was to pass away. So do you need the insurance? From a purely insurance standpoint, especially when you hear his next point, Chris, he doesn't need life insurance on his wife. His wife definitely needs life insurance on him. He doesn't necessarily need it on his wife. What you might want to do before you start throwing around that cash value, dying too soon isn't going to hurt you as the surviving spouse. You made that pretty clear. However, your wife living too long might. What if your wife was to get dementia or Alzheimer's? You said longevity might be in her family. Rather than getting rid of a life insurance, rather than keeping a life insurance policy that's going to benefit you, listener, and you're not going to need it, why doesn't your wife turn her life insurance policy into a long-term care policy that she could use if she lives a very long time? And by your own admission, listener, if you die first, she's going to be in an economic difficulty. So taking something that's not going to give her diddly squat except for a little bit of cash value and turn it into perhaps a long-term care benefit is what I think you should look at first before making any decisions on if you should close it or not. And I say that, Chris, because again, when I get to his second question, you'll see he's concerned if he dies first because his wife is going to suffer a massive cut in their pension and Social Security benefits. So he doesn't need life insurance. His wife needs longevity protection. Take a policy that he doesn't need and leverage it into longevity protection that his wife could benefit from. That's my thought. What do you think?
No, I agree. And whenever there's this question of life insurance in retirement, there's prior to retirement, there's the obvious need for straightforward life insurance to replace salary over a career that might end prematurely if you pass away and you need to protect someone who relies upon you financially. Usually if you're at the point where you can retire, there's nobody relying on you and your labor anymore for financial protection. You've got other assets, but then there's other reasons, and you mentioned some of them. Maybe there's some other risks that you could convert that policy into. Maybe there's other benefits. Maybe it does have a lot of cash value you could do something with. Maybe you need to use it for some legacy planning or estate planning or tax, mitigation for, or not mitigation, but coverage in an estate planning scenario. So you look at all those things. You look at all those things and kind of look for the best use, I guess, when you have an existing policy. Before you abandon it, you look around, make sure there's not some good use for it before you just say, well, let's just be done with it. So I agree. He should look into those types of things. I haven't heard the whole scope of his concern for his wife if he passes away first.
Right. I would evaluate, again, listener, your wife's insurability for long-term care. You need to work with a good long-term care agent. You can move a life policy into a long-term care policy. So you might be able to, or your wife might be able to benefit from moving some of that cash value. I don't know. She should explore that option. Again, you can find a LTC agent in your, wait a minute, he's in Colorado too. He lives in the Springs, I think, which made sense because that's where the Air Force Base is. I think he wrote somewhere in this that he's in Colorado Springs, but I could be totally wrong on that. Yeah, he is in Colorado Springs. Oh, and he gave his real call sign.
Let's not share that.
No, he said you can call me George. Okay. So, but he gave me
George is his call sign on the show.
On his show, yeah. But he is in the Springs. If you wanted, you can contact our office. We can put you in touch with Greg, totally up to you, or find a competent LTC agent down in your area and see if they can first determine if your wife is insurable, how much leverage she could get. And I think that could be part of your concern if you pass away first, because he continues, Chris. And he goes on to describe his policy. We won't get too detailed in it because, as he admits, he needs much more than that. He right now has a $300,000 life insurance policy from his current job, which will go away when he retires. I don't know if he's still a fighter pilot now, but $300,000. Plus, he has a $320,000 whole life policy. Now, his $300,000 policy from his employer is gone when he retires. The $320,000 one, he runs through the same issues. What should I do with it? Here are my options. But then he goes on to say, as I mentioned above, if I pass away, my surviving spouse will lose 45% of my pension, or $42,000 a year. She will lose all of my $24,000 in disability pension and $24,000 of Social Security benefits. This is a big hit to the income if he dies first. $24,000 in disability, which I believe it's a military disability, it's tax-free. So $24,000 of tax-free money, $24,000 of Social Security, and $42,000 of pension gone. He said, if I wanted to replace all that income for her for 20 years, that's $90,000 a year, or based on my calculations, $1.8 million she would need to cover it for 20 years, non-inflation adjusted. So what I'm thinking of doing is pursuing underwriting to see if I could qualify for about $2 million in permanent insurance, or at the least, a 20-year term insurance policy. I'm going to pause there. Do not assume your wife is only going to live 20 years and buy a term policy. Your wife needs protection forever. Now, I will admit, 20 years later, if you died in 20 years instead of early in retirement, but 20 years into retirement, your wife will be closer to her mortality as well, and she probably won't need to replicate that money for 20 years, which is the calculation you're trying to do, $1.8 million, $90,000 a year, non-inflation adjusted. But she might be able to use that money for other things, Chris. Maybe she needs it for LTC coverage. Even if she got an LTC policy with her life policy, it's not going to buy permanent coverage forever. She's going to need to supplement it. He doesn't share if he has children that he might like to help out and things like that. I just don't like covering with a term policy, which has a finite date it's good to, for a risk that is infinite. It's not going to go literally forever, but we just don't know when she's going to die. So I would hesitate buying a term policy. And honestly, listener, there'll probably be very little difference in premium between a 20-year term and a life policy, depending on your age. I don't know how old you are now. But if that 20 years is expected to capture most of your remaining life expectancy, you'll see the difference in premiums is not going to be – it'll be there'll be a difference, but it's not going to be that meaningful, I don't think. Okay.
Well, and – just because this income is, I want to point out, just because this income is going to go away, doesn't necessarily mean you absolutely have to replace all of that income. This is where a plan comes into place. And looking at the situation now while you're both alive, looking at the situation with just him alive, looking at the situation with just her, just him alive is not an issue because all this income is going to continue for a single person. So if it's plenty for two, it's going to be plenty for him alone. But look at it for her and see what the situation is. And there, the need for life insurance might not be as great as you imply with your approach, because we don't know the whole story. So we're kind of going by his conclusion that he wants to replace all of that. You may not need it all. And the challenge with life insurance is, in a circumstance like this, you might actually need a declining death benefit, right? Because the place where you need the most is tomorrow. But then every day thereafter, what she needs to make it the rest of her life starts to go down. So that the tool isn't the greatest, you know, it's not a perfect tool for this.
I will say, Chris, he acknowledges what you just said, not the declining death benefit policy, but what you said earlier. He said, I know this is only part of a truly comprehensive plan, and I am not factoring in our $1 million of retirement accounts, $220,000 in Roth, and $80,000 in brokerage and $50,000 in bank assets. So he acknowledges he's not looking, he's just kind of thinking out loud. And that's where I want to take this answer as well. My original answer to you on your wife's life insurance policy of what you should do, I think you may want to look at taking a policy that was designed to benefit you and instead turn it into a policy designed to benefit your wife, who I think needs it more than you. And that would be seeing if she qualifies for long-term care. And again, seeing a competent long-term care agent who can send you through pre-underwriting, if you will. It's not quite as deep as the pre-underwriting on life insurance policies, but kind of determine if your wife is insurable and give you an idea of what that policy she has could be leveraged into long-term care. Conversely, for you, we could talk about this till the cows come home with all these what-if strategies on different types of policies, a declining benefit policy that Chris mentioned, a regular, if you will, policy, how much death benefit to purchase. We could do all that. It's silly to do any of it until I know one thing. Are you insurable and what is it going to cost? You need to go through underwriting to find that out. So you really have two choices. You can find a life insurance agent who offers more traditional underwriting options. In other words, they will ask you a series of questions. They'll kind of, quote unquote, guess where you're going to come in, preferred, standard, preferred plus. They're going to then pick an insurance company, and they're going to send you through underwriting at that insurance company. And then that insurance company will pull your medical records from your doctor. You'll fill out this big application. It'll ask you a bunch of questions. And they will come back and tell you if you're insurable and how much they want. And that's fine, but you're only going to get one quote from one company. And that company may rate you at levels that other companies wouldn't. I see it all the time in life insurance. That's why I prefer, and I said this before on this show, and I'll say it again. Go through pre-underwriting. Find an agent that will do that. And that's going to be a service offered from that agent's wholesaler or whatever wholesaler's plural that agent may be using. Some wholesalers, and we use an insurance wholesaler that employs a doctor as well as life insurance, former life insurance underwriters. They will perform underwriting on you. The doctor will evaluate your medical records. The underwriters, the former underwriters, will do underwriting. Together, they're going to come up with a health profile on you. Then they're going to shop that to all the different insurance companies that they represent. They represent 60 companies. They're going to shop it to the insurance companies, and they're going to, not to all 60, depending on the policy you want, maybe there's only 8 of the 60 that offer that type of policy, something like that. They will shop it to all the carriers that will give a quote, if you will. Those carriers, if everything from the doctor and the underwriters remains accurate, the carriers are actually giving an offer for the insurance. That essentially is saying, look, if your potential client is exactly the way you described, this is what we would rate him or her, and this is what they would pay. It allows us to see, Chris, offers from multiple carriers. And I am amazed where there are some carriers rate people, and I'm not making this up, it's literal. I have seen people preferred plus at one carrier and not insured at another. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. And that's why I like to get multiple quotes from multiple carriers. I've seen differences in premiums, annual premiums, of $5,000, $8,000, $9,000 difference per year from carriers. So that's why I like to use this. It allows us to see if you're insurable. It gives us an idea of who the better carriers are going to be, what you're going to pay, the cost of insurance. I don't know if you should be exploring life insurance, and I don't know if you should be exploring $1.8 million, $2 million, or $1 million. That, you are correct, listener, is going to take more of an analysis. You are right. This is only one part of a comprehensive plan. But why do the whole plan, listener, only to find out later you're not insurable or it's so expensive? Do the pre-underwriting first. Same thing with your wife. Figure out if you guys are insurable. What is the cost? And then start looking at options. Okay, that's all I want to say on that. Anything else you want to throw in on that?
No, that's good.
Okay. Here's one more for you. It had to do with a minimum dignity.
I'm glad it's for me because we don't have a lot of time.
But I want to make mention of it because it does tie into the minimum dignity floor discussion we just had. Hi, Jim and Chris. I just finished listening to your minimum dignity floor podcast. Mm-hmm. As a career accountant that compared actual results to budgets and forecasts, I'm assuming that every so often a plan must be revisited. My question is, how accurate do you think you are in the forecasts? I agree with Jim, though. Retirement planning is not the spreadsheet that a do-it-yourselfer is creating, mm-hmm. but the continuous monitoring of the results. I go through a pretty detailed expense budget and compare actual results every month. Mm-hmm. That might be a little excessive, but every month. What I've learned is that things always change, but overall, my household is fairly consistent and good at sticking within our overall budget. I've also learned that sometimes too much detail and too much analysis doesn't really add a ton of value. Mm-hmm. How critical is it that you go to the level of detail that you are doing in your planning? I'm just curious, and I'm sure others are. Before you answer, what I'm just going to say is you told me this all the time, Chris, because mm-hmm. I used to go into a lot more detail than you do now. Mm-hmm. I was anal, listeners. If you would have seen the questionnaire that I used to use and the depth that I was asking, Chris sat me down literally one day and was going through this saying pretty much what he's saying. He found on his own, you don't have to be that accurate. And you're not adding a lot of value if you try to boil this down. And it got me to start using the analogy, I want to be on the target, not necessarily the bullseye. So I think he's picked up on mm-hmm. a lot of what we learned ourselves doing this. But do you have any thoughts with what he asked?
Mm-hmm. Even though it sounds like we're going into a lot of minutiae or detail, most of the things where we're getting that detailed, we're asking questions that people know the answer to. And what I mean by that is the minimum dignity floor is a lot of it is what you've already been practicing for quite some time. So these numbers are quite reliable. What do we mean by that? Well, you know what your utilities bills are. You know, you aren't a 20-year-old who just got out for the first time and you're learning what you pay for food and what you pay for all these things. They have no idea. We're dealing with 50 and 60-year-olds that have been living life for a very long time, and they know, you know, what they spend on things. So we may as well ask them. So to the extent that we can get a reliable answer, the day before retirement, what you're spending on a lot of those things, the food, utilities, you know, transportation is going to change. So that's why we ask you about, you know, now versus later and that kind of deal. Since that information is there, we may as well gather it from you as a good starting spot. So I agree. There's some things where we can be pretty accurate. Other things are just an estimate. And that's why we don't ask the level of details. We believe we have are using a reasonable estimate. We put in little cushions for what we call unknowns, that kind of admitting that we're estimating and we could be wrong, and we're not concerned too much if we're wrong and you spend less. That just means the money's going to last a little bit longer. What we're concerned about is if we're wrong and you actually have more expenses. So we're usually padding some of these numbers here and there. Jim historically has wanted a little more padding than I have, to the extent where, you know, I would argue if you add padding too much everywhere, you can make the plan look, you know, incorrectly bad. You know, you can be too pessimistic in your estimates. So it's always a balancing act, but you are correct. When we move through time into the future, the reality is going to be different than the estimates. But that's where just getting kind of on the target and not hitting the bullseye comes in. We don't have to hit the bullseye to have reliable conclusions, to see where you're headed. We don't have to have that kind of precision, because you can't get that kind of precision anyway, even if you wanted to. It'd be nice if we could, but that's a dream. You couldn't possibly have a clear enough crystal ball to be precise in your future estimates. So these are, trying to stay on the target, and we check ourselves over time then and revisit the plan, particularly if there's some kind of lifestyle change. If you move to a new house or neighborhood, move to another state thing, that's a big change, right? Now utilities might be different. The taxes are different, property taxes, all that. So that's, you know, that would absolutely trigger a revisit. And hopefully you had shared some of that goal early on. I could imagine a time where someone said, yeah, we're going to stay in rural Missouri for the rest of our lives. And then if they suddenly contact us in 10 years into retirement and say, we're moving to Paris, we're going to be very different than the original projections in something like that. But, you know, that's to be expected. You have just suddenly thrown everything out the window and you have a whole new set of assumptions. So that's, we just have to deal with that as time comes. So I agree. It sounds like we're trying to be precise, but it's only, I believe, precision where it's available. We are not saying that we are going to be precise on everything, because a lot of stuff is just estimates, like the healthcare costs. We use data from a researcher that gathers data on this. Your actual experience is going to be different than the estimate. But we believe we're padding it enough and using conservative enough and gathering enough inputs that we're going to be close enough to the target for things to stay reliable. That's the goal.
Exactly. And that's why we monitor it. And that's why I said on previous shows, and I'll say it forever until I myself retire or pass away, is the plan is not just the data that Chris gets or the data you do it yourself as a crunching in your homemade Excel spreadsheets. The plan is how all of that interacts with everything throughout your life, and that it is viewed on a regular basis and updated across the board, not just the data numbers, not just the budget numbers. You need to be looking at your tax situation, law changes. I told you I spent 6 hours learning a 275-page proposal. Things change, folks, and they're going to change throughout your retirement. How those impact, and something that might impact an IRA or a beneficiary designation could turn around and impact your taxes, could turn around and impact what you do on your retirement side, how you start doing conversions or withdrawals. All of this is interacted and needs to be viewed in one throughout the year forever. Retirement is not easy. We just keep trying to get y'all to understand that. And I think you do, but the man picked up on a lot there, Chris, and hopefully our listeners do. Don't spend all your time trying to get it exact. Get on the target and then analyze how all of that interacts with your investments, especially in the withdrawal analysis and the conversion analysis and your Medicare. And should you be on prescription Part D? Should you change it every open enrollment? Is Medicare Advantage or traditional Medicare? What if they change rules? What about Irma? If you're pre-Medicare, are you trying for ACA tax credits? Are you doing 210 tax planning, or is something going to change where all of a sudden you're going to do 120 perhaps? There's all these things, listeners, that are going to change throughout your retirement. If it was easy, Chris and I wouldn't have a job and we wouldn't be paused accepting new retirement clients. We would have no job or so many openings because if it was easy, people would be doing it themselves. True retirement planning, not this AUM asset management. Here's a Monte Carlo projected quote unquote safe withdrawal analysis that they pawn off as a retirement plan, but true retirement planning that integrates all these elements and monitors them all the time and has safety valves in place in case you start losing your cognitive abilities. Or not even that, listeners. You just kind of get fed up with doing it on your own. You realize, I'm not going to live forever. I'm not getting any younger. Why the hell am I wasting time sitting in my house when I could be out traveling or fishing or gardening if it were me? Why am I wasting time doing this? That's eventually you want a plan where someone can step in and take over. Or if you become cognitively declined, a plan that's going to pick up on that and start to put in place safeguards, or to help the spouse if the knowledgeable spouse who follows the finances passes away first. What's that surviving spouse going to do? Who are they going to go to? That's why you need something comprehensive, and you need to be monitoring this. So anyways, I don't want to bemoan that, but I don't want people to think. And Chris and I chatted about this not too long ago, and we thought we don't drill this home enough to let people know, especially you do-it-yourself Vanguardian engineers with spreadsheets. That spreadsheet is not your plan. That spreadsheet is just giving you some information to put your plan together. The plan is how you're going to take that data, take those forward-looking projections, and integrate them into a well-oiled machine, if you will, encompassing all the aspects of life, because that's what retirement is. It's life, and it's going to change. You don't need to be on the bullseye, be on the target, because that target is a moving target. The bullseye is a moving bullseye. You're not going to be paying the same on utilities in 20 years. Maybe we won't even have utility bills in 20 years. We'll have a utility subscription. I don't think there'll be car ownership in 20 years. I think it's going to be subscription-based. We're either going to be self-driving cars or just a subscription. Apple is thinking of going to a subscription-based service where you're just going to get a new phone every once in a while. You're going to pay them a flat fee, and it's going to cover everything, your Apple phone, your Apple TV, internet access, everything. It's kind of interesting where they're going with it. There could be something like that in the future. So don't overanalyze it. Have a plan that will react to all that. Anyways, I just want to drill that in, that sometimes, Chris, especially this listener who's a accountant who spent his whole career trying to get everything to match up on a balance sheet. That's why they call it a balance sheet. It has to balance. Financial planning has a lot more forgiveness. Engineers, no, there's no forgiveness. You have to make sure those parts are machined perfectly. There's no room for error. It's not like, it's almost good enough. Let's take it to market. No, that's not it. But financial planning doesn't have to be that accurate. What financial planning has to do is be comprehensive and pull all those elements together and monitor them on an ongoing basis and be flexible enough to quickly react to changes when they happen, and they will happen. Okay, that's all I wanted to say.
So that'll have to wrap it for today. I do have an answer to the question about the Social Security. May as well share that real quick. If people didn't listen all the way through this, I'll mention it next time too. But when you're You get your Social Security payment, which is 1 month in arrears. The Medicare premium that's being withheld from that payment is for that same month. So in this particular case, this person in the earlier question today turned 70 in May. They were going to get their first payment in June. The withholding in that June deposit will be for the June Medicare premium. So that's what it is. It's
and that was my guess, June.
While you're paying out of pocket, you actually pay ahead, but you're getting a little bit of forgiveness because their birth date was late in the month. They're going to get their deposit from Social Security the fourth Wednesday of the month, which is going to be late in the month. But so they let you kind of free ride for a few weeks at the beginning because it's for that particular month. So there's your answer to that particular question.
And that was my guess, and that was your guess too, wasn't it, June?
I was. I said that it could very well be July because that would be paying ahead, like when you pay yourself. But that's why I said I didn't want to commit to an answer. So now I'm committing to an answer because there's the answer.
Oh, Cowboy, you were wrong on that one. But Bugsy,
I didn't answer it. How could I be wrong?
Well, you said you thought it was July. You thought wrong.
It could be.
Bugsy had it right. Bugsy, wow. Bugsy one, Cowboy zero. All right.
Bugsy. I'll remember that. So if you want to send in your own questions for the show, send them to Jim's email directly, jim@jimhelps.com, or you can go to our website, jimhelps.com, submit it through the contact form there. We do appreciate all the questions, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.